We're not getting old, we're getting better.
All right, today's March the 6th, 2009, and we're recording James Harlan. And this is Pete Wilson and Ruby Nell Wilson, and we're recording for family historical reasons. Uncle James, start out by telling us when you were born and where.
Born January the 4th, 1930. In a community called Bloomdale in Collin County, 4.5 miles north of McKinney in 1930.
And your full name is?
James Benton Harlan.
And Benton was?
James was my grandfather on my mother's side. Benton was my uncle on my father's side. A World War I veteran.
And tell us who your parents were.
My parents were J.J. Jesse Joe Harlan, my father, and my mother was Beulah Ford Harlan, my mother.
Okay. And
he was the baby of the family.
Baby of the family. Your brothers and sisters, who were they?
I had three half-brothers and sisters. I had one half-brother and two half-sisters by my father's first marriage. And then I had one brother and one sister by my father's second marriage, and I was the youngest in the family.
Okay. So your brothers and sisters' names, your oldest sibling was?
Anna Faye Edens. The other sister was Doolin Ruth Harlan. And the oldest brother was Johnny Truett Harlan. And my oldest brother is William Campbell Harlan. And my sister was Ruby Nell Wilson.
Okay. And tell us about, what are your earliest memories of Bloomdale? What do you remember about the place?
It was a small community. Had a three-teacher school. My first remember whenever I was 2 and 3 or 4 years old and on infrequent trips to McKinney, the thing that I remember the most was going to the dressing room in J.C. Penney, and I could crawl up on a box and get my head up to the window and hear the prisoners singing in the county jail that was backed up. It was contiguous to the back of the J.C. Penney department store. And these black people could sing very well who were in jail. And that was the way they passed their time. And I asked my mother, I was 3 or 4 years old, if I could go see those people. And she told me, no, and they can't come to see you. And I remember that. That's one of the first things I remember about that, because I like to hear those people sing, but I didn't comprehend that they were locked up, but they could sing. And the jail was made out of stone and steel, and it reverberated the sounds of their voices so well, and they sang in chorus, like one down the hall from the other, and they would join in the song that they sang. And it was something that I remembered from that time.
So you were there shopping with your mother?
Yes, and my daddy.
And that was in McKinney?
In McKinney. The town was the square.
And we lived at Bloomdale.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the town was the square. Where else did you shop in McKinney besides Penny's?
There were four major grocery stores on the square. There was Safeway, Piggly Wiggly, A&P, and
Pratt's.
No, Pratt's was not on the square.
No.
Pratt's was where we did our shopping,
yeah.
But it was down from the square.
Yeah.
But there was one other grocery store, and I don't remember that. There was a Chicago dry goods store. The courthouse was in the middle of the compound up there, like it is today. It's all vacated now. But all of those shops that were there then are now antique places. Mm-hmm. And it's one antique store after another, mm-hmm. all the way around the square and then down on East Louisiana.
Was there a bank there on the square?
There were two banks there on the square. There was the First National and the Central National. They were both national banks or operated under a national charter.
And what about the post office?
The post office was two blocks east of the square. It still stands, and it's today a Civil War museum.
What about other places in McKinney? Did you ever visit anywhere in McKinney besides the square?
Oh, yes. I was there. But I think...
We went to McKinney quite a bit.
Yeah.
That's what he's talking about.
I learned the greatest lesson about the transition of industries and the cause and effect of these and how it affected the populace. And we were in my early childhood, and I was born 3 months before, or about 2.5 months before the last Great Depression. Like all recessions or depressions, we were all different people in different vocations were affected differently. And our lifestyle and the way that my mother and father and my brothers managed our life and our way to live was very successful in the agriculture industry. And we raised our cattle, we raised our beef, we raised our pork and our hogs. And my mother, with great, she never changed. But the treat at our home, we had pork and we had beef. But that wasn't the luxury. On Sunday, my mother fried chicken, and she always had a chicken to fry because she set a hen every 6 weeks.
Or the incubator, don't you know?
Yeah, but she didn't do that. She didn't use that very often. She set this hen every 6 weeks with about 20 eggs under her. Well, about 12 or 15 of them would hatch. And that would be our chicken. So we always had fried chicken. But the thing that I remember so much about the transition of those times, down on what they call the picnic grounds, where we had the old settlers reunion every year, and they call it the Collin County Picnic, or the old...
Was this in McKinney? Or
McKinney.
In McKinney.
And what I remembered, the best horses, the best working animals were a Missouri blue-nosed mule. He was a pulling mule and a good mule, and he was very stable, and he worked well, and he was a prize to own. And in 1936 or 7, I was with my father down across the tracks next to the old picnic ground. And there was about 35 or 40 Missouri blue-nosed mules that were not selling. The traders and the people that farmed, and that was the only farming and ranching, mile ranching, was the only industry they was around Collin County at that time. And everybody liked these mules, but they wouldn't sell. And I asked my father, why are all the mules here? And he said, well, son, they can't get rid of them. He said, what they're doing now is buying tractors. They're farm tractors. So this displaced all the people that raised the mules, who traded and sold in this endeavor, okay? And the transition from one type of power on the farm changed from the, and we had four or five cultivators of different kinds that did different things on the farm. And everything was done with these mules and these horses that my father had. So he yielded finally and bought a tractor. And bought it in 1937 from John Deere Tractor Company in Anna, Texas. And that started the change and it was not only my father that did it. By the 1940s, tractors were roaring everywhere and doing the farming. But it was a transition or a change. And this displaced a lot of people. The people who made the horse-drawn cultivators, and they were three major wagons at that time. And these wagons was Peter Shetley made them. John Deere made wagons, and Paul Studebaker made wagons. And they made all the wheel goods industry. Horse-drawn vehicles. And what a lot of people don't know, that one of the reasons and causes behind the Civil War that's rarely ever mentioned, these men had big plants in Indiana and in Illinois and up and down the eastern seaboard. And they made chariots, they made stagecoaches, they made every kind of horse-drawn vehicle that could be made. Now, the cultivators that were used in the farming industry were made in Wisconsin and shipped down here. But these men decided in right before the Civil War, and my father told me about this. I never saw it in the history books. But these three men moved their industries to Richmond,
Virginia,
and to Atlanta, Georgia. And what they did, they rented or leased slaves from slave owners, built big barracks to keep them in, and that way they could build their wagons and everything cheaper. But this caused a serious financial hardship because the wagon plants and all of these plants that manufactured wheel goods and they were shipped on the railroads were displaced because they had moved to Atlanta. Now the slave trade was taking away the industry from these. So this was one of the things that sparked the Civil War, and it was money being put in the wrong place. And that's why Richmond, whenever he went to Atlanta, he burned it. because of that. At least my father and some other people told me this. Mm-hmm. And whenever I was in the third grade, and we were talking about the Civil War, and then this was what come in as a part and a reason. Yes, it was over slavery, but it was because the way the slaves were replacing a lot of the northern labor market, okay? Mm-hmm. And they were leasing these people for so much ahead, and they had to furnish them food and clothing or whatever their requirements were, and medical, and then the slave owners got so much money for each slave that they leased to them. But that was just some of the history that come across in that time that I never saw it in the history books.
Now, what else, you of course were young during the Depression. What else do you remember about the Depression when you were very young, like when you were 6, 7, 8? Do you remember anything else?
Yes, I remember the meager food that the children, we all carried our lunches in those days. In the early days, we carried our lunches. And some of the children had very little in their little lunch sacks.
But we always did.
But we would divide what we had, because our mother fried pies and we had good things, and she'd make us good sandwiches and biscuits and sausage, her homemade sausage, and jelly sandwiches and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. And this, to some of the eyes in the room whenever I was eating, I could see the hungry eyes, and I still remember those hungry eyes. And I would pinch off part of my sandwiches and give to the children, because I had more than we could eat. But we raised everything we ate. We had everything. We had to buy sugar, and we ground our own flour.
Yeah, that's right.
Sometimes we ground our own meal from our corn. We would buy pepper, salt, sugar, coffee. And coffee was 22 cents a pound, ground coffee. 4 o'clock coffee was the brand.
Now, tell us about when you were young, and what part did you have in the farm? What did you do on the farm when you were, say, under 12 years old? Did you work?
Yes, some. I would go to the cotton fields with my sister and my brother, and I had a little bitty sack, and I'd get tired and I'd lay down on it and go to sleep. But they would pull me in the wagon. I had a red wagon they had bought me, and they would put cotton in it, and it scared me. And they love to scare me. And but that was some of the things that I can remember. They were hard times, but they were good times.
Now, how big was your farm?
In the one, my father, he would rent a lot of land. We never owned it, but he rented it on a third and a fourth. But when we were farming with horses and a two-row tractor, we had about 215 acres under cultivation.
And that was in Bloomdale?
In and around.
In and around Bloomdale. And you say we rented it for thirds and fourths. What does that mean?
The landlord, the person who owned the land, you paid them a third of the yield of the cotton and a fourth of the corn.
So you raised mainly cotton and corn?
Yes.
Okay.
But Dad didn't own
livestock production was ours.
How many different places did you live in Bloomville? Just one?
Yes, just one. We left there in the second year of I was born there, 1930, as I stated earlier, and we moved from there in 1942. We moved to Princeton, Texas.
Now, when you were still in Bloomville, tell us about your school. When did you start school, and what was it like?
I started whenever I was 5 years old.
Okay, and you went to school in Bloomville?
Yeah.
Bloomville. We had 3 teachers in that school.
You remember their names?
Yes. Hilo White, Marinelle Biggerstaff, and L.C. Clark.
Okay.
He was the professor in one of the schools. Then we had a professor by the name of Cox. I remember him. Then we had a lady before my time that taught her. Her name was Bellis.
Yes.
Miss Bellis.
And who was the other woman that taught there? Do you remember?
Richardson, Miss Richardson.
And they lived out there in that
house. Yeah, there was we had a housing for the teachers. The teachers made $91 a month. That was
now, you called some of these men professors. Why were they, that they were teachers?
They were the boss in the school.
Okay.
The man, the principal, was always a man in those days. And they called him a professor because he was in charge of the other teachers.
Now what,
Mr. Mosley.
One time, not during my time.
No, not your time.
Now, what did the school building look like?
It was coal-fired, 3 rooms, 3 huge classrooms, and there was dividers in there where the doors would fold back, and you could have one big auditorium out of all 3 rooms, which was quite a modern innovation for that time. And they had social functions there. Not a lot, but bands.
They always had plays at the end of school, didn't they?
Yeah, we had it. And then we constructed outside the school a stage.
Yeah.
And it was made out of bridge plank, just thick. Mm-hmm. And it was erected, and all of the players in this school plays were local people, and they put on this play, and they would practice for this play for about 4 to 5 weeks,
yeah.
2 nights a week that they would go to school, go down and play. Now, nobody was charged to go to this, but when school was over and ended, we had a huge potluck dinner.
Yeah.
Where everybody from miles around come and brought some food, and then that night we had the play. And I believe it lasted 2 or 3 nights, like Friday night and Saturday night.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember anything about the plays? What were they like? What were they about? Or the names or anything like that?
Well, they were more or less stories about people, their antics, their lives. They had a story of sorts to tell, and it was about someone. The one I remember, my oldest brother was always the star, Johnny. He was the star of the show. And it was a story usually that related to the endeavors of people in a little bit upper crust situation that were not involved in agriculture or anything near agriculture. some form of domestic life in the city and their antics and what they did and so on and so forth, and the affairs that they were having. This guy was going with this lady and their courtship and so on and so forth, that sort of thing.
Now, you started in the first grade.
Yes.
Now, obviously, there were grades together in the schoolhouse in the three different rooms.
Yes.
So, like the first, what, three grades?
The first, second, and third were in one.
Mm-hmm.
The fourth, fifth, and sixth were in the intermediate, what we call the intermediate. And the seventh and the eighth were in the professor's room. And then the kids, when they got out of that, caught the bus and went to McKinney to high school.
Now, what kind of things did you study when you were in the second, third grade and in there?
Very basic.
Everything? Like arithmetic?
Very basic. Reading, writing, and arithmetic.
That's it.
The three R's. Mm-hmm. That was it.
Now, how long did you go to that school?
From 1935 to 1941.
So you finished like the sixth grade or something there?
Yes. Sixth.
Then you moved. You moved to Princeton, you said. Your whole family moved to Princeton.
Yes.
And why did they move?
Why?
Mm-hmm.
Because my father was a close friend of a man by the name of Roy Roberts in McKinney. And he managed the land, the rental of land, and for the herds and the crates, okay? They were the big, big landowners of land around there. So he offered my father what my father felt like was a better deal. Mm-hmm. So we went there and lived, moved on what we knew then as the herd ranch.
What was the house like there?
It was a common bungalow house with no insulation, of course. It wasn't heard of in those days. And it was no inside plumbing, which inside plumbing hadn't come to the country by that time.
Yeah.
And
how many rooms did it have?
One, two, three, four.
Four rooms.
That was at Princeton, wasn't
it? Do you remember what road it was located on or anything like that?
Yeah, go back the other day.
Mm-hmm. And so what's there now?
All the houses that were there then are gone now.
Mm.
And the roads have been widened, of course, and paved, and there are some beautiful homes there, you know, bricks. And
now, going back to your house in Bloomdale, how big was it? What was it like?
It was a two-story house, had four rooms upstairs, all bedrooms, had on the bottom floor, had a front bedroom where I was born. The next room was kind of a living area where we had our big stove and where we congregated and got our lessons and that.
And that table.
Uh-huh.
That table.
And then the kitchen.
Yeah. There was a table in the dining room, wasn't it? That's where we studied, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Now, okay, so when you went to Princeton then, you started going to, what, Princeton School, and how was it different from Bloomdale?
Not a great deal.
It was a lot like it.
It was a lot like it. It was a little more, as I look back, I think that I got a better education in Bloomdale than I did in Princeton. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't know any of the children, and that was a distraction. the classes were much larger, and there wasn't as much attention from the teacher to the individual child in Princeton that there was in Bloomdale. Mm-hmm. I see that in hindsight.
Mm-hmm. And so you stayed in Princeton until when?
Until 1944, and we moved to Coppell.
Okay, so in 44, you would have been in what grade?
I was in the ninth grade.
Ninth grade. So you just started high school.
Yes.
And so you actually went to high school for part of a year at Princeton?
Yeah, I was double promoted twice.
At Princeton.
He was the smartest one.
At Princeton?
In Carrollton and Princeton.
In Princeton. Okay. Let's see, before we leave Bloomdale, what else was in Bloomdale besides the school?
The clubhouse.
What was that?
It was a place where all the ladies in the community congregated, and they had quilting parties there, made quilts. They did their canning there.
That canning.
They shared a lot of stuff, the mechanic, this stuff for canning, and they would can beef.
That's
and
nice.
Pork and all the attendant things, and they would can put it up in tin cans, okay? And this was the functions there, and it was a kind of a social thing that all the people, and we would gather at the clubhouse. And it was a nice facility. It had a sink in the side of it, as I recall, and had all this stuff, and they would have suppers there, and so on and so forth.
And were there any stores in Bloomdale?
Yes, one.
What?
Verbee's store, Verbee's. And it was just a small, what we would call today a convenience store. It carried a few grocery items, sold gasoline, oil, petroleum, and kerosene that we all used. And he lived in the back of the store. He was married to a lady by the name of Patsy Crutcher.
I forgot that name.
Now, I assume Bloomdale's not a town anymore, is it?
No.
Is there anything there that you recognize when you go there?
The old store is still there. It was built up on stilts in the back. The road, the ditch there was very deep, and they built this store up on stilts, a big, like, cut-off telephone poles. It was well-supported and everything, but, of course, it's not a store anymore, but the old building, at least parts and pieces of it, are still there.
It's just there. It's not a store or anything
anymore.
It's just kind of rotting away.
And that's right. And the other thing that was there was the church.
Yeah.
The Church of Christ. It was there.
It was called the Bloomdale Church of Christ.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, mm-hmm. It was. My father was the elder and the deacon and whatever else. Mm-hmm. He more or less did everything about the church. And
mm-hmm. So how often did you go to church?
Every Sunday.
Sunday morning.
No Sunday night services unless it was
having the meeting.
They were having a meeting.
What about any other time? Wednesday night or anything?
No.
No.
Just Sunday morning.
Sunday morning.
But usually. Now, what did the church building look like?
It was a white frame, and it was, for some reason or another, it was built pretty high off the ground. You had steps on both front of the thing that were, I'd say, comfortably 8 to 9 foot that you walked up those steps to get inside the structure.
8 foot high?
8 foot high.
Oh, wow.
Very, I don't know why, but the church was built that way for some reason. I'm sure, because probably there was what we called a branch behind it, a small body of water, mm-hmm. and I think they built it up so that in the event of a flood that it would not flood mm-hmm. the church. And the school was up on a little bit higher plane, like the school was over here and the church was here. And the seats in the church were made of a real dark stain, almost black,
mm-hmm.
and they were slatted seats. They had cracks in between each one, and they were not comfortable at all to sit in.
Did they have backs on them?
No, yeah, they had backs, but no cushioning of any kind,
mm-hmm.
no air conditioning. All the women had fans, what they call a palm leaf fan, and they were all doing this number, okay? And my mother.
What, did you have a lot of windows?
Yes.
A lot of windows.
Yeah, they did.
What about there's no baptistry?
No.
No. So did the preacher have a podium? Or
yes.
A podium?
Uh-huh. He did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, when you moved to Princeton, it was a bigger town.
Yes.
So it had more churches.
Yes, but the Church of Christ was much, much smaller.
In Princeton.
In Princeton.
And it was called the Princeton Church of Christ.
That's right. I sat on the back row of the church with Audie Murphy, the man that was a celebrated hero of World War II.
And he went to church there.
He went to church there in 42, and he was inducted. And he came to church on Sunday with his cousins. They were Murphys, too.
And they lived in Princeton.
And we all sat. They liked to sit on the back seat of the church, and I sat back there with them.
They lived in Princeton?
I don't know where they lived. I think they lived in some little, like, Culioke, or Audie Murphy was born in Bonham, Texas, but he migrated and lived, all of his family lived in Farmersville. But his nephews that he come to visit all the time, I mean his cousins, were all Church of Christ and come to Princeton because they live close to Princeton. But Audie would be visiting them and we would all be together.
So, what other churches were in Princeton?
Baptist, the Methodist, that was it.
And what about the businesses? How much bigger was Princeton? Was it? Did it have a lot more businesses than Glendale?
Well, it had a cafe, it had a bank, it had a big grocery store in Princeton called Jesse Brothers. It's a big grocery store. They had a drug store run by a man by the name of Coffee. And
did this town have a town square?
No.
It was just on the road. The businesses were on the road.
It was set off the main road about a half mile.
Now, what about, let's see, I'll have to go in order of everything. The school, before we finish up Princeton School, it had 8 grades, or did it go all the way through?
Graduated.
It had a full high school.
Right.
All the way through 12th grade or 11th?
All the way to the 12th.
12th. Okay. So, you stayed in Princeton then until when?
Through the 8th grade.
Okay.
Yeah. And then we moved to Coppell.
And that would be in what year?
42.
So living with you when you moved to Coppell was your mother, your father, you, and who else?
My oldest brother, Johnny, was going to service.
Okay.
Dub was going to college at Arlington, a military school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just us.
But just the three of you moved to Coppell.
Yes.
Now, before we talk about...
Well, no, she moved to Coppell.
Yeah.
Later.
No. She was with us. You met Wheelis. Well,
in high school.
Yeah, y'all were married before we moved to Coppell. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Before we talk about Coppell, go back to Bloomdale and Princeton and tell us what your life was like. Besides going to school and church and working on the farms, what else did you do? What about your friends and what did you do?
Mostly my pastime was hunting squirrels and fishing. I love to fish and hunt, okay? Mm-hmm. And at Princeton. And I did so when we lived at Bloomdale. You know, I had a rifle and I hunted squirrels and but there wasn't any fishing there, but there was at Princeton. I could go fishing at Princeton in what is now called his Sister Grove Creek, which now is what made Lavon Lake. And I had a host of friends, both places, most of which now are deceased.
What were some of your friends in Bloomdale?
My friends at Bloomdale was Weldon Crank.
Yeah.
Charles O'Neill.
Yeah.
Eldon Donahue. He was a Chinaman boy. Struck by lightning twice. If that's believable, he did. He was struck twice. And the prophet's children were our friends. The Lewises.
Yeah.
They were a family of people that we were very close to. They were churchgoers, like went to the same church that we did. We all went to the same schools. And we kind of grew up together in that sense. They were very, very large families. And,
James, who was your teacher when you started school?
Hila White.
And see, Miss Manning was mine.
Yeah, I know.
Who was she taught at there. Princeton? Who were your friends?
Charles and Shorty Barnett. They were neighbors and went to school. We all went to school together. The Myrick family, we were all friends, and they lived not right down from us on the herd ranch, Arlie Myrick family. And
this herd ranch, was that spelled H-E-A-R-D?
Yes.
Because there's a herd museum.
Yes, same people.
So it's the family that gave that museum.
The herd museum.
Did you ever meet any of those people?
No.
They just owned a lot of land.
Yeah, and like I said, Roy Roberts managed the farms for him. Mm-hmm. And then his son became a state senator from McKinney, Collington.
Okay, let's talk about, all right, so you said that you and your mother and father and Ruby Nail, right, moved to Coppell, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
In 1943. 1943. And tell us why you moved.
Or maybe it was 44, but we moved because my father met a man who was the president of Oil Well Supply Company. His name was Whittakin.
Do you remember his first name? We can't seem to remember his first name.
No, I never heard his first name.
Yeah.
Whittakin, Mr. Whittakin, was all I ever knew. And he had this farm, the Coppell, and it was a beautiful farm. And he and my father rented the farm from him. And
never heard of it till
Now, you were living in Princeton, and your father knew Whittington.
No. No, he got acquainted with him sometime. Yeah, he got acquainted with him while we were living at
Princeton.
And he advertised in some fashion that he was looking for a farmer. And my daddy went to his office in Dallas, which was on Lamar Street. And I was with my daddy. And he interviewed my father for this farm. And he agreed. And so we moved down here then.
Okay. Now, had you ever heard of Cobell before?
Never.
And so you packed up and moved, what, in wagons? What did you move?
Oh, no. Yeah. We were very mobile in this time.
Car.
Yeah. The only time we used wagons to move was right before I was born,
right,
when my people moved to Blue Ridge, and they moved from the Burris place, what they call the Burris place at Bloomdale, north of Bloomdale. That's where she was born.
Dub too.
And Dub. Yeah. And they moved to Blue Ridge. Now, this took a day and a half in wagons.
Let me get this straight. This is before you were born.
Yes.
So before Bloomdale was Blue Ridge.
Yes. And before they were Bloomdale first.
Oh, really?
Then they moved from Bloomdale, or the Bloomdale community,
mm-hmm,
on what we call the Burris place. While she was an infant,
mm-hmm,
and so was Deb. And honey, I know you were born in 22 because my mother was holding you whenever they hung Ezel's step, and they brought him, his body, to bury him after they hung him to the Horn Cemetery. And Mom told me this story many times. She was rocking you, holding you, and they came by the window, mm-hmm, with the hearse did, carrying him to McKinney. And that was the most shocking thing I've got to tell you about that. I was there in 1970.
Well, wait a minute now. Let me get this straight. So you lived in Bloomdale first, then
we lived
moved
in Bloomdale.
To Blue Ridge.
We went to Blue Ridge and stayed 1 year.
Yes.
And then
29.
And then moved back.
Back to the Scott place where I was born. They lived there, y'all lived over there 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
They lived in a small community called, can't think of the name.
I can't think of it either.
Moreland.
They lived in Moreland, which was north of Blue Ridge.
So let me get the order. You lived in Bloomdale first, then you moved to Moreland,
uh-huh,
which was close to Blue Ridge, and then back to Bloomdale,
uh-huh,
and then to Princeton, then to Cobell.
That's right.
All right. Now, when you moved to Cobell, you were on the Whittington Farm, which is, of course, is the land that's across from the school, across from what's now bigger than elementary,
mm-hmm,
school. How many acres were there?
About 115, 20 acres.
And what did you raise there?
Cotton, corn, alfalfa.
And you went to school then at Cobell School, which was across the street.
Never went to Cobell.
You never went to Cobell.
Because I was in the ninth grade when we moved there, so I went to Carrollton to school.
You graduated at Carrollton, didn't you?
Yes.
And you went to Carrollton for then 4 years, or did you?
4 years.
Four years. And so you would what would you do? Catch the bus?
Yes.
Yeah.
And the bus, it run 40 miles each way to get to Carrollton.
Okay.
The bus did not go from Cobell to Carrollton.
Yeah.
It went from Cobell down to where 114 is now,
uh-huh,
all the way down 114 to the traffic circle, which was in the north edge of Dallas, which was what they called the Leetot community.
Yeah.
Okay. Then we went north on 77,
uh-huh,
which is now 35,
uh-huh,
to Farmers Branch and picked up children there. We were picking up children all the time because, the, you know, the and the, then we went to Carrollton's school.
Now, so there was no high school then other than Carrollton in all that area?
All that area.
Okay.
Farmers
how long
Branch.
How long would it take you when you got on the bus at Cop Hill to get to school?
About an hour and 20 minutes. In the morning and then the evening.
Mm-hmm. All right, and you went to school at what was called Carrollton High School, was
yes.
it? And that was on what's now Beltline
uh-huh.
near Josie Lane or
yes.
something like that.
Still there.
Yeah.
Right up on top of the hill.
Yeah, it's a middle school now. And, well, let's talk a little bit about Carrollton. What was it like going to Carrollton High School after you'd been in these smaller communities?
Well, it was very hard for me to go to school. Why? Because all my classmates were older, much older. Mm-hmm. And as I mentioned earlier, I was double promoted twice.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's smart.
And it just, I didn't have, the girls wouldn't go with me, they looked at me like I was a baby or something. And the boys, I was too little to play on any of the teams, so, the ball teams. So I was kind of a displaced young man in many ways. I always think that that double promoting a child is not the best thing for them. The great thing that children learn in school is the association of being with children of their own age and their own ideas and their, you know, that culture. So there, for me, it was a real drawback because I was just turned 16 when I graduated, mm-hmm. and they were all 18 and 19, mm-hmm. all my classmates. And though 2 or 3 years is not much now,
yeah.
when you're
yeah.
once you're adults, but from in that time, it was a big breach.
Tell us about then what activities did you do in high school? Did
right.
you do any? And that was partly because you were traveling back and forth.
Well, yes, a lot of it, mm-hmm. a lot of it. But too, I was too young to get on the football team
mm-hmm.
or the basketball teams, and you know they were the senior boys, and
mm-hmm.
you know here well, I'm 15 and they're grown
18.
Young men, grown, you know.
What was the school mascot at Carrollton?
We didn't have one.
You weren't the Lions or something?
Yeah, the Carrollton Lions.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. What was when you graduated, what was the ceremony like? Where was it?
It was a conventional commencement exercises, baccalaureate,
mm-hmm.
As I recall. And
baccalaureate meaning at a church?
No, it's just a religious
yeah.
thing that was done in the auditorium.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And then was it done at the same time as graduation?
No,
it was different.
Two different.
And then your graduation, remember how many were in your graduating class?
About 31.
And did you have robes and caps? And
oh, yes.
What color were they? Black?
Blue.
Blue. School colors were blue.
I don't know.
It must have been blue. Do you remember who was your speaker or anything like that?
No, I don't.
Okay. So you graduated in what year?
46.
46. And you were still living at Cobbville?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to stop here and change the disc. All right, Uncle James, so we're continuing our conversation here. Let's go back to you had graduated from Carrollton High School in 1946,
Six.
And you were still living in Cobbville. So how much longer did your family live in Cobbville?
They lived here until 1949.
Okay.
And then they moved to McKinney.
Back to McKinney. So they lived here for 5 years or so.
Yes.
Is that right? Still on the Whittakin farm?
Yes.
And by the way, you said they rented the Whittakin farm. Was that still the same arrangement? You paid by a certain percentage of the...
I'm sure it was. Yeah. I never knew, but I'm sure it was.
Okay. After you graduated, you were 16. After you graduated in 46, you still lived in Coppell then. What did you do after you graduated? Did you work on the farm? What did you do?
No, I went to work in Dallas at a wholesale grocery. Their DBA, John Sexton and Company.
Mm-hmm.
And they manufactured and sold to institutions. They did not sell to grocery stores or retail places or wholesale places. They sold directly to institutions like restaurants, convents, schools, this sort of thing.
They sold groceries.
They sold groceries, canned food.
And I think somebody else, some other relatives worked for John Sexton.
My brother Dub worked there.
Right there. And he had gone, you said, to a military school?
Yeah, but he was, the war was over and he was back as
okay. Dub. All right. And so when you worked in Dallas, did you live in Coppell or did you live in Dallas?
Well, I lived in Coppell some, but... for the most part, I lived in Dallas.
Okay. Where did you live in Dallas?
On a small side street just off Ross Avenue in Dallas, North Dallas.
Okay. Now, I want to get any memories you have of Coppell in the late 1940s. Can you tell us anything you remember? You didn't go to school there, but did you remember anything about the school? You lived across the street from it.
Yes. A lot of the children that went there were friends of mine. The McDowells, the Joshua Matthews, a good close friend of mine. He went to school there, and there's just a host of kids that I knew that went to school there. Mm-hmm.
And of course, it was an eighth-grade school, so they were having to go to Carrollton after
eighth
grade.
That's right.
Now, your mother worked at Coppell Schools for a while.
She worked in the lunchroom.
Yeah, cooking.
Cooking.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember what years that would be?
Yeah, that was in 44, as I recall, 1944.
Okay. And so if you lived in Coppell, you were around Coppell a lot. You had friends here. Did you fish and hunt and things in Coppell?
Fish and hunt, and we had a movie in Grapevine.
Yeah.
That was a Saturday night affair that we went to Grapevine and went to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the Saturday was the big day, you know, mm-hmm. And my father bought me a car in 46, 47.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to Dallas and dated and so on and so forth.
What was the name of the movie in Grapevine?
It was just the Grapevine movie.
Mm-hmm.
And had a marquee.
The Palace?
They didn't have if it had a name, I don't remember what it was.
What kind of movies did you see there? Do you remember?
The conventional stuff mm-hmm. that you see on television today mm-hmm. is the, you know, Clark Gable, all the movies, all the people that were, you know, very strong in that mm-hmm. time.
What else did you do in Coppell? Was there any other activities in Coppell?
Yes. I wasn't involved in, but there was a daily game under a cottonwood tree about 100 yards from where we're sitting now, around the corner, and there was a domino game that went on there every day, except Sunday. No domino game on Sunday. And some of the older people, older guys in that played in that, sat there in that game. It was right across the street from the post office and the general store. That over on the west side of the street under this huge cottonwood, and it was always cool there. And we had a man here at that time, and he was a recluse of sorts. He lived with his dog in a shack right beside the right across from the store. Where the store is sitting now, mm-hmm. and where the post office.
Well, let's locate this place. You're talking about on Bethel Road, what's now Bethel Road, on the north side of the street, which would be that side.
Uh-huh.
And it was a general store.
Uh-huh.
And across the street from it was this man's shack.
Yes.
And the cottonwood tree where the domino game went on was west of that.
No, it was right beside his place.
Right beside the store.
Not beside his shack.
Oh.
His shack was there where the store is now. There was a store built there right after he died. And
So this would be across the street.
Yes.
From one of the general stores. You've got a general store here.
Uh-huh.
And across the street was his shack and the cottonwood tree. So that would be on the south side of Bethel. About where the Cavell Deli is now, would guess.
Yes.
Okay. So, they had a domino game. It was outside under the cottonwood tree.
Uh-huh.
And who were some of the guys who played in it? Well, tell us who the guy was who lived in the shack.
Stoney Kirby.
Kirby.
Never, as far as any of us ever knew, he never had a bath. Very uncouth type of guy. And he incurred the wrath of the local boys, and the boys incurred his wrath, and they didn't always get along too good. But his habits was he would eat, and whatever was left over, he let the dog eat. And then the dog would lick the plate clean, and he'd set it back up on the table and eat out of it the next day. And everybody in town knew him, and we didn't know he had any money. And when he died, we carried him to Faust's funeral home in Grapevine. And they cut his clothes off of him with scissors. And he had a money belt on him with about $55,000 in it.
Oh, come on.
You didn't know that?
I guess I did, and I've forgotten.
And the state got that money because he had no heirs. And, of course, the spouse got the money to bury him, of course, out of it.
Where was he buried?
I don't know.
In
Grapevine, in the cemetery there, I think, because we didn't have one here.
Yeah. What, so he didn't have anything to do with the domino game? He just lived?
No, he did. He played the dominoes every day.
Oh,
he and Pless Carbon was one of the players. I'm trying to think of some of the others.
Wood?
They were the two main ones.
Wood?
Wood, yeah.
Somebody named Wood?
Uh-huh.
Herschel Wood or something?
No. Herschel Wood was a very industrious mechanic that lived here and worked in, had a shop in Grapevine.
Okay.
And
but this was Mr. Wood, Mr. Wood, I think.
Yeah, well, and, it was Herschel's father that you're talking about. And they lived just down the street and on the same side as the store and the shack was on.
Yeah, so on the south side. In an old house that used to be next to, well...
The Baptist Church.
Yeah, next to the Baptist Church. Okay.
Or the Church of Christ. I think at one time we had two Church of Christ here, didn't we?
Yeah, they moved into that old building one time.
Yeah. Okay, it was right beside it.
Yeah, but it's beside what's now the Chamber of Commerce, but anyway. Okay, so the domino game went on every day. Now, was the post office across the street from that domino thing?
Yes.
Or what? Yeah. So it was where there's a pretty much where it's always been up until they modernized. Let's see. What about the trains? Do you remember trains in Calpell? Tell us about those.
They came through with great regularity.
Uh-huh.
They were huge engines, steam engines, that were stronger than most. And at night, you could look and see the firebox would light up, and you'd see it going down the road. And they weren't burning wood. They were burning coal.
Uh-huh.
They fired them with coal. So they laid out a horrendous amount of black smoke all over the country. And, you know, they blew it every crossing. Mm-hmm. But there was the railroad was a cotton belt route.
Mm-hmm.
And it went from here, I points west, to all the way to Kansas City.
How many times do you remember the train stopping in Coffeyville?
Never.
It never did.
It did stop at one time, but that was before my time.
Okay. So it just went through.
It just went through.
There
was a depot up here on the right next to the tracks, but I've never seen the train stop or deliver anything there.
Do you remember what the depot looked like? This would have been in as late as 1946 or something we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
Now, as late as 1946, what did the depot look like? Because we know there was a bigger one and a smaller one and that sort of thing.
It was pretty well a uniform building, about like all of the others, approximately 42 foot long. A good educated guess was about 16 to 18 foot wide. Had a platform, small platform in front, and it was there to service Railway Express. You see, the railroads carried packages in those days, and then that business went to the buses. And now it's gone to outfits like Overnight and KKK and all these others. But Railway Express was and they had wagons up there in front that stayed there as long as that depot was there. And finally they tore it down.
Mm-hmm.
But when my brother and her brother got killed in Louisiana, and we had his body brought back here, or his wife did, Betty, and it was shipped Railway Express. And I had...
So when the train did have things to deliver, it stopped.
It did, but I've never seen it stop.
And this building, do you remember if it had a sign on it?
Yes.
It just said what?
It just said Railway Express.
Okay. Did it say Coppell?
Didn't say Coppell. It didn't say anything.
Okay. Now, did you know Clayta Harwell?
Yes.
How did you know her? What did you know about her?
Her husband cut my hair every 3 weeks.
And where was his barbershop when he cut your hair?
Right on the corner where it is now.
So the corner of, that would be South Coppell Road and Bethel Road, where there's a little barbershop now. But it wasn't in the building where it is now.
Yes.
It wasn't in a little building. Was it in a bigger one?
No, it was like that right now.
So that very building, that little building that's there.
One chair in it.
Was there in 46.
Yes.
I seem to remember when I came along and had a haircut, seems like the first haircut I got was in his house next door. But do you remember anything about that? I always assumed his barbershop started out in the house and then moved into that little building.
No.
But you remember getting a haircut.
Yeah.
So your first haircut was in that little building.
Oh, no, my first haircut was in McKinney.
Oh, okay, well, yeah, of course, because that's where you live.
But that's, he always cut hair. And he was a news source of Coppell.
Yeah.
This
is Floyd Harwell.
Floyd Harwell.
Uh-huh.
And he had a son that went to high school with me, graduated.
Billy Harwell.
Billy Harwell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he graduated with me. I think he's dead now. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah. So this is why. Shirley.
Really?
Yeah. And so he was the town gossip, or collected all the gossip?
Well, he knew everything that went on, and he was very inquisitive about a lot of things that could be construed as personal things. He just wanted to know everything that went on around, and, you know, he was a very likable man,
uh-huh.
You know, but he was, but the one thing that I can remember, we were during these years, and over in the general store, we had a big wood stove.
Mm-hmm.
And chairs that sat all the way around it.
Right.
And
let me get this straight. This is the general store that would be on the north side of Bethel Road. And was it the only store, general store
that
there?
That was the only store, then.
Then. And it was a big frame building.
Yes.
And the post office was to the east of it. East side of it.
Yes.
The east side of
uh-huh.
it. And what else was around that general store?
That was it.
Nothing else. What about the Washateria? No, not there yet. Okay, so go ahead. They had a big wood stove.
Wood stove, and this is where everybody congregated and sat around and talked, and there was chairs and everything. But anyway, everybody in Coppell that wanted to work could work. The plants, we had North American, became Vought Aircraft, Chance Vought Aircraft, was then, during the war, North American. Okay?
And that was in Grand Prairie?
In Grand Prairie.
Yeah.
Okay? And everybody wanted a job could go over there. Then there was a place next door, there was a huge plant called TEMCO, TEM, Texas Engineering Manufacturing Company. They did a lot of repair work on airplanes for the government. Okay? And they finally become one company, all right? But anyway, there was work for everybody. And we had a guy here in town. His name was Preacher Denton. He wasn't a preacher, of course. But he had an old ragged truck. And he would do hauling for whoever wanted something hauled off. Okay, that was the way he made his living. And he was in the store one morning with the bunch sitting around the table back there, and Denton Preacher was crying the blues about he didn't have any money and he was having a hard time and he was crippled. So he said he wasn't able to go. He said, "Well, Preacher, why don't you let your wife go to work at the plant? They'll hire her." "No," he said, and his wife was notoriously ugly. I mean, she invented ugly, okay? But anyway, his reply to Bud Parker, who owned the store, he owned the store at that time, and he said, "Why don't you let her go over to the plant and go to work?" He said, "She'd make good money." "No," he said, "I'm not letting my wife go in that plant." He said, "You throw them fish in the pond together, they're going to mate." So everybody, Bud Parker, he just died laughing. And all of us did, you know, but that was his story. And another incident that happened in the post office, before it skips my mind. The Parker brothers, Bud ran the store, and Clyde ran, he was the postmaster.
Okay.
Very congenial man, very nice to everybody. Everybody liked him, didn't they?
Mm-hmm.
Both
mm-hmm.
of them, very, very fine men.
Bud Parker.
Bud
was
and Clyde.
Both
but anyway, this woman came in. If memory serves, her name was Perkins. And she bought a 3-cent stamp for a letter, okay? And she laid down a nickel, I remember, and got 2 cents change. And he handed her the stamp, and she took the letter and the stamp and pushed it over to Mr. Parker, the postman. He said, "Miss Perkins, I don't get paid to lick the stamps." I've never forgot that one. I've never forgot it. And he was just as stern with it as he could be, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So she just picked it up, you know, and turned around and turned her back to us and licked it and stuck it on her, pitched it in, and out she went. But, you know.
Do you remember any other people who congregated in the store around the fire?
Well, Mr. Woods,
yeah.
Like I said, in the domino game, whenever the weather was such that the weather prohibited the domino game, they all went over to the store and sat in the store.
And eventually that domino game moved to in front of the post office and store because they built something over there across the street and the tree was going.
Well, that's where it always was.
I thought you said it was across the street from the store.
Across the street from the general store.
Yeah, so
the across the street from the post office, right there under the cottonwood tree was right across the street from the post office.
But see, when I was growing up, the domino game was in front, not across the street, but right in front of the store, in front of the post office. And I remember those old men still lying there. And then the next place it moved was behind the post office under a tree. And then the man who owned the store in those days, his name was Schaefer, Mr. Schaefer, decided it wasn't appropriate for these old men to be playing dominoes. So I think he moved in a little building on down the way back behind the Baptist church.
Oh, really?
And made a domino hall for them so they'd have some place to play.
I was gone from it. But what they did do, not a lot, but some, they gambled a little.
Oh, really?
They gambled on this, and it wasn't the kind of conventional dominoes. It was some other kind of a game you play with dominoes.
Yeah.
But they gambled a little on it, okay?
Who was in those?
Well, he's already listed them.
Cliff Carbon and Mr. Woods and Stoney Kirby. But I don't see how they sat at the table with him because he stunk so bad. He stunk to high heavens.
Before I forget it, we know that Cobbell School burned in 1949. Do you ever remember that, or were you gone by then?
I was gone.
You were gone by then. All right, so after you lived here, then you moved to Dallas and worked. Did you come back to Cobbell after that?
Yes. The wife and I went to work at Vaught, Chance Vaught. And she and I lived and rented a room from the Ratcliffs, which was almost directly across the street from the farmhouse where my father and mother had lived.
And their names were what, Ratcliffe?
Their daughter lived here for a long
time. Their daughter was, the Ratliffs, I know who they are. I think he had initials. He went by.
Yeah, he did.
But anyway, you
very
lived,
nice
you, lived that, you and your wife. Now, where did you meet your wife?
At Sexton.
Okay,
she worked there.
There, too.
She worked there, and Deb worked there, WC.
Okay, so you all three were working there at the same time?
Yes.
And you met her there, and you got married when?
We got married in 48.
And her name was Opal, of course.
Opal.
What was her last name?
Van Bevers.
Okay. And was she any kin to the Van Bibbers who lived here?
No, they were Van Bibbers.
Oh,
yeah.
And she was a Van Bevers, B-E-V-E-R-S.
So you got married and then moved and lived in a room that you rented from the Ratliffs.
Yes.
For how long?
We lived there with them about 6 months.
And then what?
We moved over... on the road where
Fleet Road.
Well, it's where Mr. Terrell and where Rubenell and Wheelis lived on one side, and Opal and I lived on the other side.
Yeah. This is what we call Fleet Road in those days. These days, the name changed to Sandy Lake, but it would be, you know, it's Fleet Road. And you lived in a white frame house with a porch on the front, or a screened-in porch, on the north side of that road. I would say it was less than a mile, maybe only half a mile, from what's now 121.
That's correct.
Okay. And you lived there for how long?
We lived there a couple of years, 2 years.
Your first child was born there.
Second child.
Second child, so you had two children. And all this time that you lived there, you were driving and working in Grand Prairie.
Yes.
At Chance Vault.
Uh-huh.
And where did that Opal work? Did she work or not?
She worked at an insurance company in Dallas.
So she was working too.
Yes.
And you lived, and across the street on the south side of that road were Rubenell and Wheelis.
They lived there a little before we moved there. They had done moved here and built this house.
Yeah, this marina.
Well, they didn't build this house. They bought this house off a man by the name of Ledbetter, who was the brother to the Ledbetters that lived down here for so long.
So his name was Buford Ledbetter,
yeah.
And he was brother to John Ledbetter.
Yeah.
Okay, now, so Mom and Dad, that's Rubenell and Wheelis, had moved here when my father was got out of the war. Moved here in 1946. And you lived over on Tweet Road. I was born, and then you bought this house that we're in now, 417 West Bethel Road, and moved in here because I got the deed and everything.
Yeah.
Okay. So they tell us something about you. His name was, what was the man's name who owned the house they lived in? Or
They didn't own it. Yeah, I think he did. His name was Terrell.
Terrell.
And
it was a farm?
Small farm.
Uh-huh.
With some pasture. And we all went to church together at Grapevine.
Okay.
And his name was Raymond Terrell. His wife's name was Susie Terrell.
Okay. And where did they live?
They lived in Grapevine then, but they originally lived in the house, and whenever they moved out, Rubenell and Wheelis rented it for a while.
And where did Uncle Dub and Aunt Betty come into this? They lived
there also.
A house nearby?
Yeah, no, in that same house.
So at one time or another, Rubenell and Wheelis and Dub and Betty rented the same house that the Terrells owned.
Uh-huh. And then they moved down here and bought a little
Dub
house.
And Betty.
Dub and Betty, okay.
Mm-hmm. Moved down on Bethel Road about two houses down from my mother and father.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Didn't Terrell commit suicide or something?
Yes.
What was the story about that? What do you remember?
He the Church of Christ religion was what played the major role in that death. They believe that you are living in adultery, in an adulterous way, if you have a wife or a husband that you have put away. Now, I've heard preachers come down on this many, many ways. But anyway, we had a little preacher by the name of Ollie Duffield.
Yeah.
He would just about make look like a bar of soap after a hard day's washing. Little bitty guy, okay?
Okay.
I forgot.
And he kept pounding on this illicit relationship that these two people were going to hell when they died because they were living in a relationship.
One of them was divorced.
One of them, Mr. Terrell hadn't had a wife prior, but he married Susie, who had a husband that she divorced. Okay? They had, his name was Shattuck, and they had a boy that was named Shattuck that was the same age I was, and I ran around with him. He was a case, a bad case. But anyway, became a fireman in Dallas later. But we always figured, because he talked to your father a lot about this. It was deeply grieving to him that, you know. And anyway.
Now, who talked to my father? The preacher?
No. Raymond. Mr. Terrell did. Mm-hmm. And then when Wheelis came home one day from work, and what just had a barn, they had a barn out there beside the house and livestock in it and whatever. But anyway, you went up a ladder and went through a square hole and got into the loft of this barn. And what Terrell did, he took a rope and tied it to the ceiling joist and rafters, whichever, and then put it around his neck and then jumped through the, or let himself down, or however he did. But I think he had a broken neck. I don't think he died of strangulation, so I don't know. But anyway, by the time he did this in July or August, and the time your father found him, Quilis found him, he was black.
So my father found him.
Yes.
He was my father. And so actually, he committed suicide in the barn while my mother and father were living in the house that they were renting from.
Yes.
And as far as you know, it was over the controversy of being preached. Did the preacher preach it in services on Sunday morning and things like that? And so he was evidently driven to commit suicide over this. What did his wife do after that? Do you remember?
As far as I know, she never married again. If she did, I never heard about it.
Was there ever any, how did that affect the church in any way? Was there any effect?
No.
No, because the preacher was doing what he was supposed to do, right?
Well, yeah, I guess. But he jumped on me. He later, this same preacher.
What was his name?
Duffield.
Duffield. Yeah, Ollie Duffield.
I had forgotten. He is young.
Yeah, and he had a big wife.
Yeah.
Big, you know, and he was a little big guy.
Yeah, a little big.
Seedy looking. But anyway, I was taking my children. They were just young, to the church in Irving. And he became the church, the preacher over there.
So you had moved from going to Grapevine
to Irving. Okay.
And was it called the Irving Church of Christ?
No, it was called the Central or something Church of Christ. Still there in Irving. And he was preaching, and TVs were coming out. And they came out in 52. Wife and I had been married a couple of years. And so I bought one. We bought one. And I think Rubenell Wheelis had one.
We had one right in this room.
Yeah. And, And but anyway.
You were still living in Coppell.
No, I was living in Irving.
Oh, you were in Irving by then.
And so now he.
This is that place I used to visit down. It was close to the railroad tracks. Center. Was it Center Road or something like that?
Yeah, in Irving?
Yeah, okay.
The cemetery was right beside it.
Yeah.
This huge cemetery.
And there was a brick house next to it where a reclusive woman lived.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay, well, go ahead. I interrupted. So but you
anyway,
were going to church in Irving.
He was talking about how sinful that these TVs were. Because they took money that should be going to the church. And I told him, in no uncertain words, where he could go and what he could do when he got there. Okay? And told him to butt out. That.
Now, was he aiming that at you in a sermon?
Yeah, I was the only one that had one in church,
I think.
And he was looking right at me.
Oh.
But that was a mistake. I never went back in one after that.
Mm-hmm.
That was my last trip.
Was that it, right now?
Irving.
Irving.
Was the last time you went to the church?
Yeah, except for funerals or something like that.
Now, then just to kind of finish up, you lived in Irving until when?
We lived there 51, 2, 3, and part of 54.
And then you moved from there to where?
Hearst, and bought a home,
uh-huh.
And we lived in it for about 4 or 5 years. And I sold it, and we decided we wanted a big trailer. So we bought a big trailer, and so we could be close to her job and my job, okay? Mm-hmm. And we lived in a big trailer lot right across from Yellow Belly Drag Strip in between Grand Prairie and Dallas, so Arcadia Park.
Now, Uncle James, I remember you ran for, president of, when you worked at Chance Vault, you ran for, didn't you, an office in the labor union or something?
Oh, yeah.
Tell us about that.
Well, I'm a steward on the floor.
And what does that mean? That was
a steward. Mm-hmm. A steward, every department or a certain locale of men, usually about 25 people, you have a steward. And if there's problems of some sort that may be construed as violations, they call the steward. The person who has the problem calls the steward.
Mm-hmm.
All right? And the steward got sick and quit the company, and they asked me to take the job for a little while till they could have an election. So I took it, and I kind of got interested in labor and labor law.
Mm-hmm.
So I ran for, I did keep the steward's job for about a month or two, and then I was committeeman. Then I was over 35 stewards in that area. And then I run for chairman. You had 6 committeemen in the plant and a chairman. And the chairman was the head of the grievance committee, okay? So I ran for that, and I was elected. Then I ran for vice president of the union. I was elected. Ran for president, was elected. Then I went on staff for the UAW for about a year and a half.
And that was also in Grand Prairie? Or?
No, that was in Detroit.
Oh, you moved to Detroit.
No, I worked here in this, but my office was in Detroit and St. Louis.
I see. And how long did you work for them? A year and a half, you say?
I was busted out in 57.
What's busted out?
Got beat.
Oh, you somebody elected over you.
Yeah.
57.
I had, in 58. But then the black question was boiling. Black people could only work in plants as janitors.
Mm-hmm.
They could not, the lowest pay grade in the plant was janitors,
mm-hmm.
sweeping the floor, cleaning up. And the NAAC was coming on strong. The early movements of the what amounted to a social insurrection of the blacks
mm-hmm.
was starting to form and getting strong. And the blacks were telling me, if you don't give us a break and let us go into the shops where we can get a better job and have a better life, you know, we're going to get you. We're going to put you out.
Mm-hmm.
And the white people are saying, if you put those black so-and-sos in here beside us, you're out.
Mm-hmm.
So out I went. I said, if my position was, if they could play third base, they could get on the ball team.
Mm-hmm.
that you couldn't hold it against them because of their color, creed, or religion, or national origin. That was what
so
I felt
were,
like.
So you were, in general, in favor of blacks being able to compete with whites.
I was in favor of equality. But
then you the lost
reason,
religion.
The reason behind it, and whenever I sat in with the NAACP in 1957, an open meeting with Walter Reuther and the president of the NAACP, and we had a meeting. What we did then was not to help the blacks. It was to help us. Mm-hmm. What am I talking about? We knew by the 1950 census, we didn't have 1960 census then. We had 50. And by the 1950 census, we knew that the average black male in the United States was fathering 8 children, and probably 3 more that we didn't know about. The average white man was only fathering 4.5. We knew that by 2023, unless we changed something, that we would have been a minority, they would be a majority. So we knew that if we could get them better educated, they would, and get them the jobs that would go with their educational precedent, that we would, they would find a better social standard in life, and their birth rate would proportionally drop. It always does with any society in the world today. As you raise the educational precedent, as you move that graph up, two things happen. The birth rate decreases, the crime rate decreases. It's a win-win-win. Okay? So, for that reason, that was what backed it all. And then the NAACP said, yes, we know what you're doing. We know. Yeah. Okay? So this was what bridged the gap, and this is what started. Now, today, we're only 14 years away from that deadline that we were projecting on then. They're only 23.5%. So what we did was correct.
That's interesting. Now, after you left the union, or that job, what did you start doing then?
Got in some trouble. Got out with the wrong crowd. Got to drinking. You know, I had made big money and had everything, and I was hurt and messed up and mixed up, and got into trouble.
Got into trouble. Were you working somewhere?
No.
I remember some of that trouble, but I don't remember much of the details of it.
Yeah.
But you eventually started trucking.
Yes, I did. But I had to go to trucking because after I was out of organized labor, anybody that ever turned on a TV or ever picked up a newspaper knew who I was. Mm-hmm. And I went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Manufacturers. I went to 4 or 5 of them. I was a good sheet metal mechanic. Good. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't touch me. You're not coming in here. Mm-hmm. So I had to buy a truck because, you know, I didn't have to ask anybody for a job. I had my job.
Right.
Okay. And that's why I got into trucking, and I stayed there for 40-something years.
Wow.
And made a success of it, I might add.
Yeah.
And
that
was one of the, I'm going to tell you something. A man that can go out here can buy a truck and get his name on the side of it, and then you had to have the authority, and you had to know the right people in Washington to get the numbers and everything, because everything was regulated. But anybody that can go out here with a truck and make a living can make a living doing nearly anything, because it's hard. It's hard. And you have people that have been in the industry, and it's tough, believe me. It's real tough. But I did it for 40-something years, 48, 45, 48 years, and made a good living for my family, sent my girls to college. Mm-hmm. Oakland I did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't have any life of your own. You have no social life. You're out there whenever everybody else in town's got their feet on the table at home enjoying the meal and fixing to watch television. You're halfway between Timbuktu with a load on that truck, and it's got to go, you know, if you want to get paid. And
Tell us, I'm trying to think of anything we've left out here. Tell us, when you got a TV, I know you got a TV about the same time my family did. When you got a TV, what shows do you remember watching, or how did it affect your life, or anything like that?
Well, in the early days of TV, the networks, the national networks, like ABC, was all radio, NBC, CBS, the three majors, were all just radio. And they moved into the TV market in a very, very slow in getting into it.
Mm-hmm.
So the programs that we had were just local stuff. A little comedy, very limited type of entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think. We had a black guy, and he's always talking to this black lady, and and was kind of a situation comedy of a sort. It wasn't slapstick or it was sitcom, but very crude. Then by 1958-60, it really got going good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was coming in on network, and you know, and it was a lot better. The entertainment whenever I was young, a child, was radio.
Mm-hmm.
She and Mom, every evening, we had a battery-powered radio, okay, and at home. And we ordered it from Spiegel's catalog people, like Sears and Roebuck, somewhere up in the north or east.
Yeah.
And we had this radio, and it was run off of dry cell batteries, huge things that sat behind it. And we had show after show in the evening. And they were addicted to about two or three. And they kept their ironing board close to the radio, okay? And she was ironing clothes and had her ears changed.
Now, what years would this be? When you were real young?
36, 35, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, right on up.
Mm-hmm.
And the shows was When a Girl Marries, Lorenzo Jones, Ma Perkins, Stella Dallas, how many did I miss? And then late in the evening, the show that I love to hear was Jack Armstrong. Oh. Remember Jack Armstrong?
Yeah.
And then the select thing was a 30-minute serial once a week, Mr. District Attorney. Do you remember that one?
I don't remember.
He said in a very brave and bold voice, he said, "It shall be my duty as District Attorney not only to prosecute to the limit of the law all persons accused of crimes perpetrated within this county, but to defend with equal vigor the rights and privileges of all its citizens." That was his speech.
You still remember it.
Wow. Uncle James, we're running out of time here. Let's just touch on one other thing if I can think of, because I'm still trying to tie in the history of Coppell. When you lived here, which would be in the late 40s mostly.
Yes.
What about the roads? As you think back on what they looked like, you lived on what we now call Southwestern Boulevard, but in those days it was just called Coppell Road, I think. But
yes.
You lived there south of Pinkerton Elementary. And then if you went to the right, you came to what's now Beltline and Denton Tap. But what do you remember about that road that went north and south there?
Denton Tap was a mess. It had potholes you could bury a car in, and it was very unkempt. None of the low roads in Coppell, there was a lot of asphalted roads. They were asphalted, but they had no divider line in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
They just were, you know, room to pass.
Mm-hmm.
And after World War II, they got increasingly better and better in the time.
Like if you know where the Dairy Queen is?
Sure.
Okay. If you went to the Dairy Queen from your house to the Dairy Queen and turned left onto Denton Tap, it was potholes and everything, but you could drive down there, and then didn't 77 come through where Sandy Lake Road is or something?
No.
Denton Road?
Denton Tap and 377. No, it's on over.
In the late 40s, which may have been before the 40s, I've always heard that Denton Road came out of Carrollton and went through the north part of Coppell, turned and went to Louisville, and then later it became 35, Highway 35.
That's right. It was 77.
It was 77, and so that was...
It was 77 then, when you're describing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've always assumed, see if you agree with this, that the reason Denton Tap was named Denton Tap was because it tapped Denton Road. Had you ever heard that?
No.
Because that was called Denton Road going through there, because that's where you went to Denton.
But there was, like I said, there was on the corner of what now is Sandy Lake and Denton Tap.
Yeah.
On the northeast corner was a huge restaurant drive-in, and they sold beer and liquor, not selling liquor, they sold beer and hamburgers, and they had curb service and everything, and she and Wheelis took me there, I was about 7 or 8, and bought my first hamburger.
You remember
bought,
what the
not
name?
Not my first hamburger, but I remember Wheelis bought me that hamburger.
Do you remember what the name of that place was?
Midway.
Midway. And so you say it was pretty big.
Yeah.
What do you remember about other beer joints down there in that area?
That was about all there was around here.
In the late 40s.
And that was the first thing I remember about Coppell.
Uh-huh.
Because they said Coppell was just over this way a little ways from there, you know.
Uh-huh.
But they were in a 33 Chevrolet.
My parents drove that room in Illinois and took you over there. And you don't remember any of it, because we know that there were a bunch of beer joints over there. It's probably before that, though.
But can you imagine these two were in a courtship?
Mm-hmm.
And I'd beg and cry to go with them, and they'd take me. Well, they ought to kick my butt, and, you know.
Well, now, they were probably married by then.
No, they weren't.
Well, now, they didn't come to Coppell until 45 or 46.
I know, but they weren't living at Coppell then. I don't know what we was doing over there, how we got there.
Yeah.
But Dub was in the car, and this was in the late 30s.
Oh, so you think you came to Coppell,
or
to Midway anyway.
I come to Midway.
In the late 30s?
Uh-huh.
And you remember that?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So it's possible that you guys were around here before you realized it.
Yeah.
Because they don't.
They were that close.
Mama's story is, now see how this... See how this fits in.
In
yeah, but let's figure out how this fits in. Mama met Guy in high school in McKinney.
Yeah.
And then they got married in, when?
I had to say.
Well, they got married, and then he went to the service and was in, he was in the Army in Macon, Georgia, or somewhere.
Yeah.
And Mama went from Princeton, I guess,
uh-huh.
on the train to be with him all the time he was stateside.
Mm-hmm.
Then when he went overseas, late in the war, she came back home, and that's, she always tells the story that she was in Macon, Georgia, or wherever it was,
yeah.
and rode home, and Mimi said, my grandmother, your mother said, we have moved to Coppell. And she said, where is that?
Yeah.
She had no idea. So she did not, had never been in, well, at least not permanently in Coppell, and didn't know where it was until she came back from being with my father in the war.
I never heard of it.
And she came back and lived in that house, the Whittaker house, for a while until she moved to Dallas to work at a insurance company or something. And she was in and out for a while. But in the meantime, Mimi and Grandbet moved back to McKinney. And when Dad came home from the war, that's when they moved into the house over on Fleet Road across from you, eventually, and then bought this house we're in now.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was trying to put all this together. Dad didn't come home from the war until 1945.
That's right.
And he didn't move here then until either late 45 or something like that, and lived over there. And they didn't buy this house until late 1946, because I was 6 weeks old when they moved here. So, and I was born in 47.
Mm-hmm.
So, Mimi and Granddad
lived on that Possum Field.
I know, but they couldn't. How could they have lived here by 1943 or 44?
Who?
Mimi and Granddad and you.
We did. We moved here from Princeton.
But she would have been living with them.
No, she was
she went to school at Denver.
She was with Wheelis in Indiana.
Yeah.
A long time. And that's a picturesque town. I'd like to take you there and show you because it's just so full of history. And but she and Wheelis lived there, and they lived in Macon. But
so they evidently were in the service, my mother and father in Macon, Georgia, or wherever it was, for 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, quite a while.
Wow.
Because your father was an intensely smart man.
Mm-hmm.
And they put him in, radar was in its infancy, okay,
mm-hmm.
in the service. And he worked and developed and did all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And
hold on, I got to stop. Gonna stop. We're on our third disc here, and we're still talking to Uncle James. James, go back and tell us. You were talking about my father working in radar in the service. Go on, talk about that. You said they put him to work in on radar.
Yes, and they had largely the attack on Pearl Harbor. If we had had the kind of radar that we have, that they were trying to achieve then, and by the time the war was over and by the time your father got out of the service, they fairly had radar perfected in the military. Now, it did not advance into the private sector by police agencies and that sort of thing until the latter part of 1953 and 1954, okay? But he was a pioneer in this endeavor.
Mm-hmm.
And they carried him, I know that's what he did in Macon
mm-hmm.
on that base. And then in Indiana, when he was up there, that's what he was doing, was on new development technique in radar. In other words, taking what was there and making it better.
Mm-hmm.
That was his thing, not operating it. He yeah. did. He his job was he in and your father could have been an officer because he had the education and everything, but he didn't want it. You know, mm-hmm. he would just. He would do everything he could.
Yeah.
I asked him one time, and I don't know whether I should say this on tape or not. I never heard
Go
him.
Ahead.
I never did hear him say that anything naughty or anything right. Your father never drank beer in his life, and he never said a curse word in his life that I ever knew about. I idolized him. And I think a lot of us did that really knew him. But I said... We was talking about the food.
In the Army?
In the Army.
Yeah.
And he said, I said, do y'all have good breakfast in the morning? He said, no, we have shit on a shingle.
That's what they called it, I think.
That's what he called it. And I thought that was so funny. And what it was is a gravy with some meat in it, ham or something, and they put it on toast.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I like it. But that's what he called it. He said he got tired of it.
Yeah.
Well, now, what else do you... I wasn't planning on asking a question like this. What else do you remember about him or Mama? He went to work for Mobil or Magnolia
yes.
right after the war as a chemist.
Yes.
And he had finished his degree at North Texas, or did he come back and finish it?
No, he had it
mm-hmm.
whenever he went there. And Deb and I... Where we had a way of celebrating things, okay? And you'll think this is silly.
It's not.
But what we do when all three of us got together, more especially he and Doug, we had a special kind of candy that Wheelis dearly loved, and so did Doug, and so did I. So usually when we were all together somewhere in Dallas, We'd get this candy wherever we could get it. It was those orange slices. They still sell them in the grocery
store. I love those.
Well, he was addicted to them. He just loved them. But anyway, Deb and I were waiting to meet him that day. And he'd been out looking for a job. And he'd been out looking quite a while. He was
so
trying
was
to...
After he'd gotten home from
that,
the war.
After he'd come home from service and he was looking for a job.
And this would have been, like, what, 45?
Yeah.
At the end of the war.
Somehow or another,
I guess he didn't come home until the war was over.
Oh, no, he didn't.
Yeah, so it was 45.
45.
Yeah. Okay.
And he met Deb and I. We were both working at Sexton.
Mm-hmm.
And he met us down on the street. And we depended on each other for a ride home to Coppell. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we went and got some orange slices. I thought you did.
Naturally.
To celebrate. He had got a job with Magnolia.
Uh-huh.
And we were all so happy about it, you know,
uh-huh.
because he was happy, you know. So that's the way we consummated our relationship with orange slices.
Orange slices.
And kind of silly, I guess.
No, it wasn't.
I will not walk past them in the store today. I'll buy them.
I didn't realize he liked them.
I got sugar diabetes, and mm-hmm. not a real bad case of it, but I have to be very careful. But they'll last me for months. But I love to get them, and every time I eat one of them, I think about it. You know?
Well, yeah.
I still do.
Well, let me see. Some stories I've heard about him. You know, I've heard very few stories about him. His family, of course, lived in McKinney.
Mm-hmm.
And his father owned a drugstore at one time.
No, worked in one.
Worked in one. Worked
Mitchell's.
In drug, yeah.
Mitchell's Drug in McKinney.
And that was on Square.
And he was a great farmer.
Yeah. And then, of course, from my childhood on, he owned a dairy. You know, but, and my father... Played football, I think, at McKinney High School. When did you first know him?
At Bloomdale. The big old house where mm-hmm. we lived. And they were dating.
In high school.
This is 1938.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I graduated in 39.
She graduated 39, and he graduated in 40.
I think just a half grade ahead.
Yeah, he was half ahead of you. Or, yeah, or...
No, he was behind. He had, I don't know.
She was a year, she's exactly a year younger, but she graduated before him.
Yeah.
You graduated before him.
Yeah.
Somehow another, I don't know how, but anyway,
yeah.
Your grandfather worked the hell out of him, and I think he missed a half a year in school trying to get to help your grandfather get strung out in a big farm and everything. But I'll tell you privately, I wouldn't tell it to anybody else, but Mr. and Ms. Wilson kind of discriminated against your father. Now, God only knows, I don't know whether it was religious prejudice or what it was. I don't know what it was, and she probably knows that too.
What you mean, after he started going with my mother?
Yes, they wanted her, they wanted him to marry a rich girl there in McKinney.
Oh, a certain rich girl?
A certain rich girl.
Who was that?
Well, I used to know what her name was, but I don't really know who it was. But
did he date her?
No. Mm-hmm. He never dated before. It's lively. I can't think about it. But he used to love to come to our house on Sunday dinner because my mother always cooked a good Sunday dinner. And he loved my mother's cooking. And Reubenelle and the cooking, and we'd always. But one Sunday, this was in Princeton, and seemed to me like Willis was there, but they had baked enough pies for everybody, okay, but it was two different kinds, okay, like lemon and chocolate. As I recall. Mm-hmm. And there was enough pie to go around, so everybody could have a slice of pie, okay? Because there's a lot of people there, you know, when the preacher come home and all that. Mm-hmm. This old preacher was a glutton boy, and he's a big guy.
Who was it? You remember him?
Wright. His name was Wright.
Yeah.
But anyway, she asked the preacher which what kind of pie you want? Do you want lemon or do you want chocolate? He said, both, please.
Yeah, I've heard him quote that.
He embarrassed the hell out of everybody at the table because there was just enough pie to go around. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But we always had that fried chicken. That was the luxury on Sunday, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And the Wheelis, boy, listen, he loved to come and eat with us and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So he dated you, and then you graduated before him and immediately went to school in Denton.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would drive to Denton sometimes, and you two would be together. And then he went to school at North Texas, what was then, whatever it was named then.
It was North Texas.
North
the
Texas.
One she went to was called CIA.
Yeah, and later on they called it PSCW.
Yeah, and it's changed names half
and
a dozen
times. And originally, North Texas was called North Texas State Teachers College.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know what it's called when he went there, but anyway,
he
got a degree in chemistry there.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting story was, when I enrolled as a freshman at North Texas, in those days there was no computers, of course, and you had to enroll by going to the library, and they had a big table set up. And if you wanted in a class, you had to go to a professor sitting there and sign up.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to major in science, just like he did. And I went up to sign up for chemistry. And this guy behind the table looked at my name, Willis Wilson, Jr., and said, did your father go to school here? I said, yeah, he did. He says, yeah, he was in my class. And it was his major professor. I can't remember his name now, but he remembered my father from all those years before. But anyway, he went to school there and graduated evidently right before he went into the Army.
Yeah.
I guess. And then that was how all that developed, I guess. And then he bought this house.
After he got out of the service.
Mama tells the story that she had been in this house one time when the Ledbetters lived here. And she came to a wedding shower or something, a baby shower.
Yeah.
And she thought it was the most beautiful thing she'd ever seen in her life. And when the Ledbetters decided to move back to California, I think, they didn't like it here. They had only been here about a year or longer. Granddad heard that he was wanting to sell his house and then told Wheelis. And then he bought it on the GI loan.
GI loan was paid down a month at a time.
Well, yeah, it's like they do now. And there was no back on the back of it. And he and Rush, what was his name? Bill Rush.
Yeah.
And sometimes helped him build that background.
Are they dead, Ruby?
Huh?
Bill Rush and his wife.
No, I don't think so.
I don't think so.
They moved a long time ago, but I don't think so. At least they weren't some time ago.
They were neighbors and real close friends.
Yeah,
and
yeah they were.
The Rushes.
We lived down there in a little house that they built. And then I look at, I looked at pictures, what pictures we have of this house, and there was not a tree anywhere around it.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing. It was barren here. Before I forget it, when you lived here, do you remember any kind of business being on this corner, our corner here?
No.
Right
across the street was a dilapidated, what was once a drugstore.
Yeah. And I have a picture. And I remember that.
Do you?
It was still there, boarded up when I was
boarded up in the...
And we have one picture of me in the backyard with that store in the background. Do you ever remember seeing a bank in Coppell?
Never been one.
It was gone when you were here then. It was built... Oh, it was built in the 20s, I think, but it went under before the Depression. It was right up there by the post office.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
but this town didn't become incorporated until your father took a hold of it somehow or another. And they incorporated it, and he and Billy Harwell were the people who were instrumental in getting Coppell on the road to...
Yeah.
What he was.
Well, they were two of them. Did you know Barbara and Richard Lee?
No.
They lived, both of them lived here, I think, all of their lives, at least Barbara did. Barbara was a Melton. And they lived a little bit south of town, out on a farm. But their lifelong residents here still live here. She's president of our historical. But I think I asked her if she knew you, and she said she didn't really. And, of course, Pat went to school here. A while. And I can't figure out how Pat fit in.
What's her last name?
Pat, our Pat.
Oh,
Pat
Patricia. Cope. Yeah.
She lived with Granddad and Mimi and Granddad when they lived here.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So when did she start living with them?
When she was 6 weeks old.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So she lived with them in Princeton.
Yeah.
Yeah. All then, through. All the way.
And then moved here with them and...
Lived just like my sister all the way through.
Yeah.
What happened? She was born 36. The heat and heart of the Depression was really rolling and boiling. And the only employment anywhere around McKinney was a cotton mill.
Right.
It was still operative. And Ida Faye worked there some and everything. But
and Reese did too, didn't he?
Yeah. No, he worked for... some people who owned the bottling company in McKinney made RC Cola and Knee High and all those drinks. He was working for them, and they liked him very much, okay? But anyway, their marriage was very unsettling from the jump.
This is Ida Faye
and
Reese
Edens.
Eden.
Mm-hmm.
And they... got off on a bad start, stayed on a bad start, and
from
the very beginning. And Ida Faye married him to get away from my father.
Mm-hmm.
Because my daddy was part of the Victorian time when never... if a girl made one false step or put on too much lipstick, she was a marked person in the community, and she embarrassed the entirety of the family and all this sort of thing. So he put the heavy hand pretty well on Doolin and Ida Faye.
Mm-hmm.
And they were pretty radical and this, that, and the other, and he was on their case, and you know, and you could say it was kind of a tit for tat thing.
Yeah.
And but now he got along great with her.
Yeah.
Never a problem. Okay. She had a couple little tiffs with Mom, but she did great. Okay. But anyway, Pat was born after they married, and Ina Faye would just go off and leave Patricia with
Mom.
She'd leave him with people in McKinney.
Yeah, you're right.
Different people keeping her. And Dad would find out about it. He'd go by and get her and bring her home. You know?
Mm-hmm.
He'd say, you know, she's going to kick her out of here and put her on. So, and from the time she was 6, 8 weeks old, she was with us all the rest of her life.
Mm-hmm.
Until she was adult and got adult and married.
Okay, there is one last thing.
Whatever happened to her? I haven't seen her. She got mad at me 10 years ago over what she got mad about and what set her off. Ina Faye, I went, you know, I trucked out of Colorado. I hauled potatoes out of there all the time. And at least once every month or month and a half, I'd go 50 mile out for out and go through where she was at, and I'd stop and see her and everything. And she got progressively worse as time went on. But the last 20 years of her life, she was kept in a Catholic home. And they kept her like a queen. You could walk in there at 2 o'clock in the evening, at 7 o'clock at night, at 5 o'clock in the morning. Everything was pristine. Everything was clean and perfect. And Ida Faye had joined the Catholic Church, okay? And there was some rebellion about it. Our people, all Church of Christ. But Pat wanted to bury her mother in McKinney. And I knew where Ida Faye wanted to be buried. Her and Doolin had two lots. Me and Opal had two. Willis and Rubenell got two. And, you know, we all paid for them. And that was where the designated burial place was. And Ina Faye was kind of funny, but she was stopped. She'd gone to Mexico City to do something in the early 80s, and about 1980. And she come back, and she stayed with me in the Rio Grande Valley for about 2 weeks because I kept an apartment down there. I was running a trucking company for two Japanese brothers, okay? And I was living down there, and I'd catch a plane, come home about every other week, okay? But I kept a car down there. And Ina Faye come stay with me a couple of weeks with some people who were friends of mine, invited us over to Padre Island for the weekend, a picnic and all this. So I took Ina Faye with me. And we were on 100 Highway going over there, and there's a beautiful cemetery there. Just gorgeous. And she and I were driving down the road past the cemetery, and I said, Ina Faye, look at that cemetery over there. Isn't that beautiful? And she said, yes. I said, you know, we got a beautiful place to place where we can all be put whenever we're dead, too. And she said, yes, and you bury me beside my brother. She never would claim Johnny or I, but she says very emphatically, I want to be buried by my brother, talking about Dub.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, really?
So there was no question in my mind where she wanted to be buried. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a devout Catholic, had been for 25 or 28 years. So I bucked, and Pat got mad about it. She wanted to bury McKinney, and they wanted, I think the consensus was to have a Church of Christ funeral. I said, it don't make any difference under the law, precedent law. We are entitled to whatever religious persuasion we may have, or none, if that be the case. And it should be respected regardless. I mean, whatever kind you are, if you're a holy roller, then I think the right to exercise that right goes through your death, I guess is what I'm saying. But anyway, she's been mad at me about it ever since.
She's buried in wrestling.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
She's buried right where she...
Where she wanted to. By the way, before I forget, I have, this is just a personal question. Those plots that all of you guys bought at wrestling, when did you all do that? And what was the... Whose idea was all that and everything? Because I know...
We were all at McKinney on Dad's place, 1950, and this salesman called on us, and it was some by prearranged deal. And this, where we bought these 12 lots, was not even finished, okay? It was just... It was actually, you had another cemetery that was contiguous to wrestling, all right? And a lot of that wasn't developed, but they bought that cemetery and they started selling these lots. Well, we paid $1,600 for those 12 lots undeveloped, okay? And anyway, this was 1950. And we paid, like Rubenell Wheelis had paid 1 month, and Dub and Betty had paid the next month, me and Opal had paid the next month, Johnny and Estelle had paid the next month, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's the way, we each made 2 payments a year.
So there were 6 of you. So that's you and
6 Opal, sets of us.
You and Opal, Dub and Betty, Mom and Gay, it must have been Mimi Granddad.
Yes.
And then, who? Doolin? Doolin had 1 lot, I guess?
Yeah, Doolin and Ida Faye.
And Ida Faye had lots.
Right.
So that
and she made the payments for her and Ida Faye. And all through Ida Faye's adult life. And whenever Ida Faye died, Doolin had a stack like this of where she had sent Ida Faye $50, $25, $75, $50, and they were the bottom side. In other words, you go to the bank, you buy a cashier's check, all right? You get a duplicate of it, and that's what they were. And she had them all. And I'm going to tell you something. They must have been 150 to 200 of them. She'd always sent her $50 every week or 2 weeks, you know, to tide her through, you know, she'd always took care of her, always.
The reason I ask about the lots is because, the wrestling plots, is because Betty, of course, still had one left next to Dub. Well, she obviously wasn't going to use that, so she gave that to me.
Yeah.
And I always planned to be buried there, and about 2 years ago, I wrote out a will and had a lawyer do it, and also specified all my, and I bought a pre-needs thing through wrestling, and it's a long story, but I specified that I would be, that at least there would be a marker, I'm going to be cremated, but there's going to be a marker there in wrestling, unless Coppell ever got a cemetery. Well, now it has one, and I've bought a lot there. So I'm going to end up with an extra lot at wrestling that's worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly what to do with it, but I don't want to just leave it.
You can tell the time might come when Bill's children, something could happen.
Yeah.
Something could happen to some of the grandchildren here, and they need a lot, and they are young, and they think, well, I'll never need one, you know. And you got it to take care of that emergency.
Right.
So hang on to it.
Well, I probably will. They tell me it's worth about $6,000.
Yeah,
something.
It's worth a lot of money.
Okay, I keep saying this is the last thing, but I've got to ask you about this because this is going to be lost to the family if we don't get this recorded. I need you to tell me details about Aunt Dude. Not so much toward the end, but in the beginning. Mom has told me stories about, you know, her and Henry. And it was all, in the family, it was always an open story about her and Henry. I mean, even as a little boy, I understood who Uncle Henry was. So there was never any question about all this thing. But I want you to tell me what you know about it, because we don't have those resources to remember all that anymore. And I wish that I had always thought somewhere along the line that I would go to Aunt Dude and say, Aunt Dude, let's write this down. You know, you don't want to keep it a secret anymore. Let's write it down. And, of course, then she was gone. So tell me about Dude. I remember the story starting that she was, what, as young as 17 or something?
Yeah, I think so.
And you mentioned the fact that she and Ina Faye were kind of rebels. So tell me what you remember about Aunt Dude and what all that stuff, and Henry and all that stuff that went on.
Well, she was a flapper in the 20s, what they call a flapper.
Yeah.
You know, the dancers and all that. And but she had a few dates with other men and boys in her. She never finished high school.
Yeah.
Okay?
She went to high school.
McKinney
also.
Rode a jitney. In those days, there was no public bus fare anyway, but they brought a jitney. The jitney come out of Salina and come through and picked up kids and took them to school, and mother and dad paid the bill, okay?
Okay.
And they accused her of having an affair or some kind of affair with a jitney driver. I remember that.
Who?
Well.
Grandma?
Doula.
But I mean, who accused her?
Dad.
Oh, really?
See. He saw something that I don't know what he saw. But anyway, she never had a serious love affair with any man until she met
Henry
English, H.E. English. And he was a married man.
Mm-hmm.
And he did not have a conjugal relationship with his wife. They were separate, gone. Okay?
They were still living together.
No.
No, they weren't.
No. They lived, I think, in the same house, but it was an estranged thing. After his boy was born, and he was...
He was a lot older than she was.
Well, he was born in 1901. Okay?
And she was born in...
1914. So he's 14 years older than she was.
Okay.
And he, she was, well, in my considered judgment, you know, I was right along there with all of it and everything. I worked for him.
Yeah, I forgot that. You did, yeah.
I worked for him. And,
but that's after she knew him.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Now, he was already wealthy.
Well, yeah, what he did, in the early days, when transportation was in its infancy, other than the horse and buggy, okay? And they set up an organization, which still exists in Texas, a regulatory agency called the Railroad Commission. Because at the time it was created, that was the only mechanized kind of transportation there was. Mm-hmm. Was the railroads.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, this commission could tell them where they could build a railroad and so on and so forth under the eminent domain laws that were in existence at that time as well. Well, Henry got rights given to him to operate a bus line between Greenville, Texas, and Dallas. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So he'd load chickens and ducks and anything people had to come into Dallas, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Then he made application and got granted authority to run trucks. He sold his bus rights to the Moonies. That was his kinfolks, close kinfolks. And they come from a little town just outside of Greenville. Okay? And him and the Moonies. But the Moonies bought his rights to that, so he got into the trucking business, hauling business. And he had authority from Dallas to Lufkin to Houston. But he had closed-door rights, what you call closed-door rights. He couldn't go from Dallas to Houston. It would go through Lufkin, okay, in Houston, all right? But anyway, he expanded that from time to time. And he bought other lines and got the grant and the blessing of the commission to do it. And yes, he ran himself up to a sizable fortune early on when everybody else was having a pretty tough time. He was making tons of money because, you know, the government set the tariffs or the charges that they could charge, that the freight companies could charge. But anytime they wanted to raise, they just go down and ask the commission. And I think there's a little bit of this under the table. I don't know. But anyway, that's how he got started. That's how he acquired his wealth. And through all this, he was living with my sister on occasions and whatever he was doing, they were doing. But they had a pretty torrid love affair.
Where do you think they met?
She was working at a department store, and he came in and bought something or ordered something.
In McKinney or Dallas?
No, in Dallas. She got a job at a company called A. Harris & Company, and later became Sanger Harris, and now it's gone. But anyway, that was the way that happened. And,
so he walked in and bought something, and they met.
So they had
affairs as early as what? She was pretty young.
Yeah, as early as the early 40s,
Yeah.
And
did the family know this?
Yes. She'd come out every time she'd come out to Coppell. She'd come in a different car, okay? And she sent me out one time to get something out of the trunk of the car, and I opened the trunk of the car, and there's a whole three cases of whiskey. So I just lifted one, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And showing the boys, the McDowell boys, and all the boys in Coppell, what a drinker I was, and I drank up the whole thing. And we had a cabin down here in the woods where all these fine homes are now. And
who's we?
Me and the McDowell boys.
Oh, the boy. Oh, okay.
And so they were going to come after us. And anyway, we started shooting at, I thought somebody was after us or something. You know, I was out of my mind. But anyway, they finally corralled me. I fell over the stove or something. I was soaking wet. And my dad carried me home. I was sick for a month. I was sick. I mean, just sick. I'd lay down in the bathtub and turn the water on, let it run my face and get my mouth and get back in the bed. And, you know, the old man never said one word to me. You know who he took after? Doolin for bringing it out there.
It was her fault.
It was all her fault. See what you've done to your baby brother. Look at him. You okay? But anyway.
And how old were you?
I was 11, 12.
Now, I wish you'd tell me where this cabin used to be.
It's, you know where you're going down Bethel,
uh-huh.
And you bend.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
Back to the north.
Okay.
Okay? Right there across the road in those woods right there.
Okay.
That's where it was. And Mr. McDowell and Dad carried me out feet first, head first, and put me in a car and Dad took me home, you know. And
you didn't know about that?
Yeah, I've forgotten it.
Okay, so she came out in a different car every time and visit. But anyway, she was living with him or something. She always had a separate house.
Oh yeah, he bought her houses.
Yeah.
He bought her a house out on Denton Drive, right off of Denton Drive, mm-hmm. And he bought her one on La Vista.
That's the one. And then, yeah.
And
then that's still there.
She bought that house where, and you know what happened to it. I told you what happened to it.
Yeah, she lost it.
She lost it.
Yeah, but the house she died in.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she went from a house on Denton Road, you said?
Was right off of Denton Road, back in there, in the Love Field, right there in the Love Field area, mm-hmm. Right up against Love Field,
yeah.
Because the plane that took off or something to go over the house and you know.
And then he bought her the Vista. He had to buy it because she didn't have much income.
Well, of course not.
But anyway, the only thing he gave her $50,000 whenever she bought that house on where she was, mm-hmm. you know.
But she owned the apartment house next to the La Vista.
Yeah, she owned them both. Uh-huh.
And don't you think he bought that to give her income?
I think so.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then
she was good to him, and I mean, he was real good to her, but she'd accuse him of something all the time.
Yeah, that's her.
You know, and, you know, I mean, well, you know, she was just hard to live with, really.
Yeah.
Really.
All her life.
All her life. And yeah, I mean, she, you know, but that's the only man she ever loved. It's the only man she ever had anything to do with, and I know anything about.
Well, she, now let's see. You were saying when she moved from La Vista to the brick house on Skillman, it was actually on, what was the name of that street? You used to know it.
Oh, where she lived?
Yeah.
5411 Ledgestone.
Ledgestone. Okay. When she moved there, did he buy that house for her?
No, he gave her $50,000.
To buy the house.
Brought it out there in a sack. I was there when he came.
And you saw him give it to her?
Yeah.
He just gave it to her in a sack. And did she buy the house with that?
Well, she didn't pay $42,000 for that home.
So she bought it with the money he gave her right then.
But it was in such bad repair. When she died, what I'd done, I borrowed $153,000 on it. Okay? And I got people to stay. She did not want to go to a home. Okay?
No.
And she, boy, listen. The two or three times she'd come out of the hospital, and I could put her in what they call a care for 60 days. She'd drive these people up the wall.
Oh,
boy, they'd tell me, come get your damn sister and come get her now. You know, and we're going to call, because under these government programs, see, under the Clinton administration years, whenever his mother was dying with cancer, and he said, you got Medicaid care, but when people get out of the hospital, lots of times they may be well enough to leave the hospital, but they're not well enough to go home and take care of themselves. Mm. So they get 60 days in a care place. Mm. But in order to stay there, they have to do therapy every day, you know, a certain kind of therapy. Get up and walk and do those. She wouldn't do it. She'd give them all kind of hell. They call me, Mr. Harlan, we know you're in charge, but you come down here, we're going to kick her out of here. So what I'd do is go to Fort Worth, get my lawyer. I'd bring him over there, you know, and like I'd done 40 times. And go in there, and we'd go in the office, and I told this kid, done this twice or three times at different places where I had her. And I'd say, who are you, the man that called me and said you're coming to? Yes, he said, I am. I said, I'm going to tell you something, sir. I'm not telling you how to run your business. You do whatever you want to do. But if my sister goes home now, she don't have anybody to take care of her. She's going to fall, and she's going to have some serious injuries. And I'm going to own this damn home. Now, what do you want to do? This is my lawyer. Go ahead and tell him. Well, what do you want to do here? Mm-hmm. Well, they call me back and say, well, we decided we're not going to kick him. Pull that on him so much. It was better. I had to do something, you know, because. But anyway, finally, when she brought these people in, she had over $200,000 in cash. Well, I was on all the checking accounts just for an emergency deal.
Yeah.
And I didn't know about, I knew where all the money was and everything, but, you know, nothing. And she had always been a meticulously good businesswoman.
Yeah.
You know, she paid her bills and she knew where her money was and everything. So she moved these bastards in that was taking care of her, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I know, they was doing a good job and everything, and she was happy. And they called back, called me one day and said, Mr. Harlan, we got some NSF checks down here on your sister. And I said, well, move some money out of this savings account. No, that's already been done. There ain't no savings account. There ain't no more money here. That was $120,000. Gone! In about 4 months, they'd stole that much. And so then I go to look at another bank where it said $50,000. I went in there to check on it. Gone, too. So then I come in. Then I got into it. Well, all the money was gone. She was broke. I mean, she didn't have two nickels saved together. So what I done, I took her out of Johnny's, kept her out there until I could get a loan through to get these taken care of. But I'm going to tell you something. When you're hiring people 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, it can get damned expensive if you're getting the best deal in the world. And I'm paying them all in cash, okay? But I had to account for every penny. I made them account for every dish rag. You know, they knew it, and nobody got away with anything. But when she died, I had $32,000 left, all right? And I didn't want any of it. Didn't need any of it. I owed $12,000 to bury her. And I give each of Betty's kids $4,000 apiece because they had always worshipped her Aunt Dude and took care of her and been there for her, and I felt like that's what she'd want me to do. So I gave them $4,000 apiece. Then I took the other $8,000. Well, I took $4,000 first, and I gave it to Johnny. That sorry bastard son-in-law of his stole that $4,000 before I got out of sight. So I knew it had gone. I don't remember how I knew that $4,000 had evaporated. So I took the other $4,000 and went to Springtown and bought him $4,000 on a prepaid funeral and locked it down where I can't even go in and get it. Yeah. Okay? I locked it up and everything. But that wiped out her money. But so then this house, it needed painting, it needed, the appliances was gone, everything was disarray. I spent $19,000 of my money, not Aunt Dude's money, my money, because the market then, that house was worth about $260,000 setting up straight, okay? So I'm going to get my $19,000 back. Well, this stuff, no, I lost it. I put all that in that house. And you see, after somebody dies and you got a reverse mortgage on the home, you got a year. Well, I spent 6 months of that year getting it cleaned up and ready to sell. And all the time, real estate values are just going down, 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 down. But it wouldn't have sold like it was, okay? So I put it on the market for $259,000. Couldn't sell nothing. Brought it down to $239,000, $229,000, $219,000. Trying to get this half of my money back. They foreclosed on it Tuesday.
It's
gone. But I couldn't do nothing. What I offered to take $30,000 more of my money, $30,000, and finance the rest of it. All right? That would have left, from the time that I took out the loan until now, that $153,000 had grown to $196,000, okay, in interest all that time. So, anyway, I was going to pay $30,000 of my money down on it and then lease it. Well, the house over there where it's at would have leased for about $1,800 a month. So that sounds good, don't it?
Yeah.
It is. You put the arithmetic to it. All right. If I buy this house and I move into it and homestead before anything, I can get a 4.5% loan on this house on my credit. Okay? 4.5%. But I've got a homestead where I live, so I can't have two homesteads, so I got to rent this one out down here. All right, the loan companies want 6.5% where it's income property, all right? my interest could go from 4.5 to 6.5 on a nailed-down loan. All right? Then, the next part about it, where she was homestead and over 65 and had everything tied down at the time she turned 65, which was almost 30 years ago, her taxes weren't but $1,600 a year on that house. But guess what? Whenever I bought it, it was income property. I wasn't living there. I couldn't homestead it. The taxes went up to $6,400 a year. So I could not buy it and lease it and ever hope to get back my money or anything. So I had to abandon ship. They said, "We're going to take it." I said, "Take it." Mm-hmm. So I guess they foreclosed on it.
Tell me, before I finish, I'm going to have to get out of here soon. Tell me, okay, Henry English owned Red Ball Motor Freight. That's
yes,
what his company developed into.
Mm-hmm.
And then he sold it.
Mm-hmm.
And he still lived with his wife and family. His family evidently knew about Aunt Dude.
No, they were completely gone from his family. And he lived, he had had two marriages besides, he had always told Doolin that he could not get a divorce mm-hmm. from the wife, okay? Finally, about 1969 or 70, he did divorce her and he married another woman.
Mm-hmm.
That marriage collapsed. Then he married another woman. And in the interim, he would come by and see Doolin once in a while. But they didn't get along. They were fighting like cats and dogs. But anyway, he married them a second time. But he was living in the Stoneley Hotel in Dallas. And he did not die of natural causes. He was murdered. The Moonies stood to inherit all of his fortune. And he got a double hit of his heart medicine, and it put him into a coronary.
Oh, really?
And he had given Doolin, supposedly, an iron box, safety box, under his bed. And Mooney, one of Steve Mooney, the father of these two unscrupulous Moonies, said, "My lawyer put him on the witness stand." Okay. He told Doolin that Henry had this money under the bed at the Stoneley Hotel that was hers,
mm-hmm.
close to $1 million. So we carried him to court, and they sat on that witness stand and lied like a rug about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so she didn't get nothing when he died.
Yeah. I remember it was in the Dallas News that she had sued his estate.
Yeah.
And had lost.
Yeah.
I remember he had a house on Beverly Drive.
Well, she had no provable way to prove up on what she
yeah.
alleged, because the man who had told her that this money, and he had told her,
mm-hmm.
he'd always told her that I'll provide for you well when I'm dead.
Mm-hmm.
But he said, "I can't give it to you in any way except in cash." And he told Steve Mooney to give her this money.
Well, Steve Mooney,
but he died too before we ever got it to court, so I couldn't put him under a subpoena.
Every time I ever saw Henry English, there was a guy with him.
Yeah.
An assistant or somebody.
Yeah, probably Steve.
Was it? And it was his sons then who, in effect, saw to it that she never got him.
Right. And they disinherited... Well, he had a grandson that's paraplegic or something. What's these children that don't have any mind and they won't talk? What do you call it?
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he's one of his grandson, and he gave him $1 million endowment. You know, where it'd be taken care of all the days of his life. He's got it tied up in some kind of a trust or something. But Henry's own son, LV, or what, I think that's his name. And he got very little out of the estate. But then Mooney's got the bulk of the money. And they the ones that stood over him but this medicine that he was getting,
Henry,
was very volatile, and it had to be, you know, really scrupulously watched to not get too much of it. And when he did, they think that the Moonies double-dosed him. That's what they thought, because he was all right one day.
And then the next day.
Next day, he was dead. And he was 74 years
and
old.
So I remember he sold the company or something.
He did.
Yeah.
He sold it 3 years before deregulation hit.
Mm-hmm.
And he got $43 million for the company. And then he still, that was for the authority and the rights and everything. And then 3 years later, the government deregulated it all, you know.
Yeah.
And but he still owned all those terminals,
uh-huh.
like in Lufkin and Houston and everywhere.
Okay. So I was just trying to think if we've covered all the aspects of him. I can remember, of course, you know, I remember two stories real quick. I remember one time when I was in high school, and a dude showed up out here and said, get your bathing suits, we're going swimming. And she took us to a house on Hemwood Road that he owned, didn't live in, he just owned it. It was kind of a nice model. Of course, in those days we thought it was a mansion, but... You know, it was just a nice house, had a swimming pool, and we went swimming there. There wasn't anybody living there.
Really?
And then the other story was, she was in the hospital one time, and I was pretty young, but Bill was little. And we went to visit her. Mom and Dad, me, Bill, went to visit her at one of the hospital bells. I don't know what she was in there for. And she was fine. And while we were there, Henry called. He always called first. And when you were at her house, for example, she'd let you play on the telephone, because we... country boys liked to play a phone, you know, in Dallas, because we didn't have those fancy telephones. But she'd always say, now, you can't do it anymore because Henry might be trying to call. She'd always say that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Henry called the hospital while we were there at night, and he wanted to come by and visit her. And she said, yeah, you know, they're here, come on. And so he came on. And I can remember that when he arrived with this guy, whoever traveled with him all the time, I don't know if he was his driver or what he was, but there was always two of them. He came in and he had stopped at a 7-Eleven. You know, 7-Eleven started in Dallas. And he had stopped at a 7-Eleven to buy us presents. And, of course, what could you buy at a 7-Eleven? I remember he had a thermos jug and stuff that just, he just said, here's some presents. Because he felt like he had to give us something,
yeah.
You know. And we were just like, wow. And the first thing that hit us was they were expensive. I mean, you know, who goes out and spends money like that, you know, but he did. But he was terribly generous and very kind, very friendly. He didn't stay long. You know, he brought her flowers. And we always knew who he was, always. And she never made any bones about the fact of who he was and what they were doing, you know.
And he threw me in with a black guy in the pits, greasing them trucks and
mm-hmm.
servicing them, you know, changing oil on them.
Yeah.
And I worked for him about a year and a half.
Yeah.
And one day I looked up, man, I was covered with grease. Looked up, this Henry is standing there at the edge of the pit looking down at me. I said, I think you've learned something, hadn't you? I said, yes, sir. Guess so. I said, I hope so. He said, here. Threw me an envelope, missed my hand, and went down in the floor of the... And I reached out and picked it up. The time I picked it up, it's gone. Had $5,000 in it.
You lost it?
No.
Why?
He gave it to me.
Oh, $5,000.
Because I worked. You know, I worked my ass off for him, you know.
And how old were you when you worked for him?
27,
28. But you didn't go on working for him after that?
Mm-hmm. Went on the road for him, and he had an ex-state trooper that was a captain of the state police department. He didn't like me, and he was raising hell with me all the time. So,
were working for Henry English on the road.
Yeah, driving.
Oh, driving.
And so
that's
I just walked, come in one day and parked the damn truck, threw the keys down, went out. Next day I bought me a truck for that time.
So it was Henry English who actually got you into the trucking.
Yeah.
Deal.
The way I learned to drive a truck, it was, we'd wait till quitting time and everybody go home and I'd be down there at night working. I'd take one of them out and slip around and drive it till I, you know.
Would you believe that we've spent almost 3 hours talking?